what everybody wanted. But nobody knew how to go about doing it.
Right.
And it always struck me as kind of funny that I should be the one that should come in from the prairie knowing nothing about it and sort of try to find out. But I presumed it was because I had come into a situation. I could see it from a different perspective than somebody that had sort of been struggling along there trying to make a living all those depression years.
Mm-hmm.
I figured this was what it was. But anyway, we made it. We got the place transferred over, signed up memberships, and about that time they closed down the lab part, which took a good section. All the girls, every one of them joined the union. There was no question. I had them all in there. And the next morning after we had that motion, the superintendent of the mill come and told me that I could supervise their 10-minute coffee breaks. Be sure they took no more than 10 minutes now that I was a union officer of some kind. And I just supervised. That's not my job. I said, that has nothing to do with tallying. I said, I don't supervise them. That's your business, not mine. And right off the bat, I realized I'd answered so fast, and I'd answered it without any training, what might happen, that I realized that actually I was on the right track, because his reaction was so surprised that I reacted this way. And my own superintendent was a little Englishman who was quite a good union man, and he really supported me afterwards and said he was really proud of what I had done. And I had done it without ever thinking, so I didn't feel that I'd done anything special. Because I just wasn't going to be a stool pigeon. I think that was it. And so we got along fine. But when we got all laid off then, and about that time was when the local was actually growing all over. And the organizer they had, the general secretary for the union, had been called up. He had a young guy, he'd been called up into the army. And there was another girl who come from Pyewoods, had become secretary, and she was in the office, but I don't think she had much of a union background or desire, really. Anyway, I was nominated for secretary treasurer.
Of your local?
Uh-huh. And I quit the mill on the 28th of December, and I was elected to the union job on the 4th or something of January. It was right after. Anyway, didn't give me time enough to even have a break in there. And so that was in 43, I think. Speed it up?
No, sorry. To go back over this period. okay. Were you made off? And you and the other women, were you made off in the cases?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was there any protest around that? Was there any chance of getting into other jobs at all?
No. It was a pretty clear thing. Hey, the Boeing aircraft was just obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of the mill was closed, that's all.
Right. And had you formerly had any kind of union position?
No. No, I didn't know what I was in for. I had no notion. I was scared.
And was the secretary treasurer position a full-time job?
It was the only full-time union job there was, although the district council had an office there, and it was staffed, so they did practically all, and there was organizers from the international that done the organizing. The secretary was responsible for the office and the membership dues and cards and whatever else you could do. More you got used to it, the more work you got, the more things you found you could do, you know.
Right.
Yeah, you sort of took more and more responsibility for the whole local business, whether it was organization or whether it was administration or what. It sort of more and more centered around the elected representative with the organizers doing all the footwork.
Okay. How many plants were in that local?
Oh, dear.
Like, I'm trying to figure out how many had jurisdiction over
there. The start of the time, there were probably very few that had certifications. I can't remember right now, but I think the Canadian White Pine had. One of the first things I did was get it for the Sitka Spruce, eh? Because it was just organized. But other than that, they just sort of snowballed in at that time. There was quite a bit of organization in the mills, but the certifications at that time hadn't come through at that time. The certification was just a new thing that had come in anyway, that you had to have this 52% of the workforce registered in your files as full paid-up union members before you could get certification, and then the company had to recognize us. Before that, they just had the memberships, and when they wanted to get recognition, if the company didn't want to recognize them, they fired them, eh?
Right.
So this certification was sort of if you had it at the date the certification was applied for, the company had to accept it, even if they laid off after. They couldn't lay off and protect themselves.
And that was legislated?
That was legislated, yeah. And that would have been around 43, I guess, when that was done, because that's what was, or 42 maybe. It was just when I came in there anyway.
And did that legislation make a big difference in being able to organize?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was one of the things that was forced in, I think, through organizing.
Okay.
Because what was happening was you'd go in and they'd organize a place, and then immediately they'd fire everybody that they could so that they wouldn't, anybody that was organized, memberships that they knew, they would fire them, and then you could never get enough people there at one time that you could force a hand to get an agreement.
Right.
And so this certification did protect. But what it was really designed for wasn't in any way to protect the worker as such. Even then it was designed so that the operator wouldn't be losing the wartime production that was required, eh?
Right.
By guys quitting and not having the staff. It was hard to get new people. And if they went on strike in the wartime, it was bad, eh? Beginning of the war, they weren't really all that serious about the war to start with there either. The first few years, they were letting George do it, eh?
Right. I guess that, given that a lot of the strikes in the 1930s have been around union recognition, that would tend to encourage the government to do
union. Same as the unemployment insurance. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that come in then, eh?
Okay. So you became Secretary Treasurer.
Yeah, and that lasted until 1948.
What was the local number that you used?
217.
Can you sort of take the tape through that period of time? What kind of events took place? There was a big organizing drive. Can you talk a little bit about the kind of work that you did? And what was going on in the union around?
Well, it just seemed that as far as I was concerned, there would be new plant committees coming in to the office. There were meetings every night, setting up, having meetings of all the members you could get out of a certain plant operation, getting their shop stewards set up, explaining to them how they worked. Maybe the organizers would be there, maybe they wouldn't. They'd be there, but as things went, they'd be off out to another mill, and I'd be left with the plant committee and setting up the shop stewards. And, some of the time you'd go out to the plants and talk in the lunchrooms. And it was just a continuous, there was such a demand for memberships that it was just almost impossible to keep up with all the things that was going on, because you were signing up this group and that group, and then you would be immediately trying to get certification, and that took some doing. They'd come around and check your files, and you had to have them all up to date and ready for them, and they'd check those files out, and then you'd wait, and you'd eventually get the certification, and then that was a big thing. You had to go and try to get an agreement. And the organizers had a time with BC Plywoods. I think it was the one area. The rest was sort of straight organized as they were, but the BC Plywoods had organization in there, and it had fallen apart. And to build it back up again, to get them to have the courage to do it seemed to be a big thing. There had been more women enter the plywood industry because of the war. They took over a number of jobs that were boys' jobs, very light, easy work actually. But they also took over some that was men's. And in there, quite contrary to the other places, it was the women were a little bit more difficult to get to be really interested in the union. I think some of it was that there was the past history where they had been laid off, and it don't matter, even women were easier to get rid of than men even then, hey?
Why was that?
Well, because women weren't supposed to work anyway. I mean, the old bit of discrimination against women always. To get a job in the first place and to hold it afterwards, it was always, yeah, you weren't you never considered irreplaceable. So there was an awful lot of meetings held down there and handing out leaflets, and I think that it must have been almost a year before we could get that place actually, so we felt that it was organized.
Were women in the other mills supportive of organization?
Yes, we had some of the box factories. There was one box factory, I can't recall the name of it, it was down on the river there somewhere. It had quite a few women in it, and they were really good. I can't remember her name. There was a Doris. She was an older woman, and she was shop steward there, and she had that place well organized and held it. It was nearly all women in there, and they were quite good, but it was, they never got organized until on toward the latter part of the war years, when by this time then it was getting, the pressure was on the unions not to be so organized, eh? Organization wasn't as easy as it had been before that. You couldn't get agreements quite as easy. But she was really good. I wish I could remember her name. I've tried to think of it, and all I can remember is Doris. I can see her face and remember Doris, but I can't remember her last. But she, I don't know what happened to her. But she was really a very good person. They were quite few and far between as far as women in the mills. That mill had them, and the White Pine had them. But that was a little sort of a plywood thing that they did there, too, for boxes, eh?
What about Fraser Mills?
Fraser Mills wasn't in our jurisdiction. That was in Westminster jurisdiction, yeah. We had the largest local we took in the North Vancouver, and there's quite a few mills over there. We had problems there with the creosote plant that finally made that one. And we took down along South Vancouver there, down through the Eburn sawmills and Sea Island and the shingle mills and things all along the whole bit there, out as far as New Westminster, then that become into New Westminster and local Fraser Mills and all that was out here. Do you want to take that quarter?
You're talking about where the mills were located.
Oh, yeah.
So did you reach 100% organization?
Oh, no. Mm-hmm. No, you never reached that. But we had all the major operations were organized. There were a few little ones that were outside the master agreement, but we had most of the unions just came in and asked to join at one period there, just at the time of the strike in 1946. They were coming in. We joined up then. We must have had close to 100% of the operations signed up. Are out on strike with us anyway, you know.
Why do you think it was that kind of dynamic?
I think the economic situation, the fears had left. The evidence of the improvements was there. The agreements that we signed, although there was a wage freeze, you could equalize among the different categories. You could get a better equalization and differential between the job categories and their values. You could get it signed that that is what they were going to get, and they could be sure that's what they were going to get. They were getting holidays for secure, hey? They were getting overtime rates. They were these things weren't too hard to get in wartime agreements. Even with the wage freeze, you could improve things a great deal. And I think that all these factors tended to just give an impetus to it. And when it was known that we were going on strike, you couldn't strike through the 4 years. And in 46, that had not been rescinded. The no-strike legislation was still there, and the wage freeze was still there, I should say. And there was a gentleman's compact for no-strike, more or less, but there was a wage freeze in 46, and they weren't lifting that. And so when we struck in 46, we were striking not so much because employers said, well, the freeze is on, we can't give any more. So we were striking more against the legislation than we were against employers, which was a strange thing. But this, too, I think, brought in a lot of other outside groups, because they realized that if we broke the wage freeze, they, too, could probably get an increase, that the employer wouldn't be able to say they couldn't give it because there was a freeze on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the strike was actually against the wage freeze.
It was the central issue in it, the question of wages then.
It was. Oh, well, I guess there are other issues, but this was the main thing to break the wage freeze. The master contract was pretty well established. By that time, we had one master contract for the industry pretty well. And there was always the holidays and the other fringe benefits, but at that particular time, the wage freeze was the big thing.
What about layoffs?
In 46, the layoffs hadn't really hit us yet. Well, they had there for a while, and then it had sort of equalized out. But, no, they hadn't. Layoffs, it wasn't a factor at all. It was full production pretty well. As I say, Sitka wasn't producing, but that was to be expected, and couldn't do anything about that one. But they had gone, instead of just doing Sitka, they were going into other number. So it was still operating. No, there was no problem with layoffs. There were no big question then. Seems a long time ago.
What kind of support was there for the strike by the labor movement?
Oh, it was fantastic support. It was fantastic support. I remember meeting people then that I'd never met before. Native Brotherhood, for instance, I'd never seen them, the Bakers Union.
What kind of things did these people
retail? They would give financial support, and they would come down and offer support, moral support, financial support, picketing support, anything they could give. We had it, the backing was there. We had built up a strike fund we had quite a good sized strike fund. Not big enough, but we had built it up better after that strike. It was more of an effort to build up then, but we had quite a few funds in the union. We got help from the international eventually. Wasn't forthcoming to start with, but we did get it. And we did break the miners and the fishermen. All the bigger unions were right there because the miners were ready to go out as soon as we concluded they did. And they were trying, at that time, there was a move among some of the leaders to try to get all the bigger unions out at the same time.
A general strike?
Well, not, yes, sort of, but not not really, too. It would be the miners and the fishermen didn't take too much part in that because they were AFL-AFL and we were CCL. But the steel workers and the miners and the IWA would have tied up the big unions. They were the ones that set the pace, as it were, and the little guys sort of followed behind, mm-hmm. got the advantage of it from the big unions, which is normal and natural. And the miners, I think, come out just after we went back, if I remember rightly. We went back on June the 20th. And then that period just in there, after that for a while, I don't remember too well after that strike for a bit. Lost my husband just then. Mm-hmm. And although I went right back to work, I was only half there, I guess. And things were just sort of drifting. Everybody else was doing the work that I should have been doing, I suppose.
What kind of things did the IWA do during the 1946 strike? There was some kind of a march that was organized on the island, was there? Or demonstration to Victoria?
I don't remember it being through the strike. During the strike it might have been. I don't remember that, but there were a lot of labor lobbies before that. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of labor lobbies to Victoria, all through the organizational period.
Was that by the IWA or was that by...
It was more by the Federation of Labor, which was the CCL body and would organize them. And we would be over there on various issues, holidays and whatever the issue happened to be that we were on. There would be a labor lobby every year and they'd present a brief.
And would you go on those
lines? I went on a couple of them, I think. Okay. Maybe more. I was over there several times. I also went over there with the peace movement after it was out of the IWA, so I don't remember just which ones already chasing around after these. Quite a while ago, and things just sort of have drifted away from it so much that I forget all the details of just which lobby and what we were after, because they all sort of just blended one after another, hey? Yeah. Every year, every February.
Did you continue to be elected to the position of Secretary of Treasury?
Yeah, every year you had elections for every year, every January.
Yeah. And then after your husband's death, and when you resumed work, what kind of things took place until 1948?
Oh, in that period was a little more difficult. The IWA was, there was a move in all the unions and at that time to resent the domination of the unions by the states. They were more dominated, they were more influenced by McCarthyism and almost anti-labor in their attitude. And it followed in practically every one of the international unions had the same problem. And in this period, there was the fight, the continuous fight with the international on policy. They did things like when they had a convention down in the States, and although you can't say that the international was responsible, we are convinced, or I will be convinced anyway, always, that they were, that the International Union of Woodworkers, the head office there, had any delegate elected in BC to go to that convention was screened through the passport to go to the States, the border crossing or anything. You had to go on, have a hearing, and that's when McCarthyism was high and you had to swear whether you never remember the Communist Party or Labor Progressive Party, they called it then. And every BC candidate had to go through this. Well, some of us figured it was none of their dang business. We never did tell them, hey, so we never could go. In fact, even yet, if I wanted to go to the States, I guess I should go down and go through all that bit again, get it revised. And if I'm still down as not being allowed to go to the States, mind you, I've gone across the border, but I don't have much desire to go there anyway. It doesn't bother me. But this period was dominated by that, particularly in our union, where the international had long history of being rather very right-wing, too easy influenced by the bosses and not really fighting for positions. And the district leadership under Harold Pritchett was the very opposite. It was a very leftist leadership. And I think that they did very much. In fact, I think the labor movement suffered from the break when they decided to try to break from the international and form a Canadian union. I think that was a sad mistake. I don't think that if they were leadership, if Prichette and Dalskog were in the leadership today, that they would be having the trouble between the pulp and paper workers and the IWA. I don't think any such rift would have ever got to the public. They were a strong, consistent leadership that, regardless of their politics, a membership liked. You could be sure they wouldn't sell you out on anything. Hmm? If they told you this is the way it was, we can't get any more, you could be sure they couldn't get any more by negotiations. It's a good time to strike. It's not a good time to strike. They seem to be able to lay it down and influence the membership to the correctness of it. And I think it was correct. Their leadership, all the time I was there, I learned a lot, and I figured their leadership was correct up until the point of disaffiliating. I think that was wrong. History's proved it was wrong. Not that there wasn't the reasons that they wanted to do it were valid. The membership just wasn't there. They were just too many steps ahead of the membership at that particular time. The trend was to the right in the entire labor movement. And the time had passed when they could have done it maybe a year or two sooner. Mm-hmm. But I don't think so. The membership wasn't ready for that sort of thing. As far as they were concerned, they had a loyalty to the IWA, same as I would feel it. Even now I feel I sort of have some part of an IWA in me somewhere, because it was the first organization that I'd gone into. It served me well. And I think members felt this way, sort of feeling disloyal to something that had been good to them, rather than see the real issue in the sense that was maybe more political and economic, although it had both. The economics are showing more now than it did then. Mm-hmm. But to them, they didn't see it only as a political issue, and they couldn't follow it.
It was more like they were loyal to the organization, not to the leadership
who had led it. Well, yes, there had been a real development of a right-wing, almost a Trotskyite element. It was a real organized attempt to break the leadership as it was. Mm-hmm. Now, it's possible that they'd have broken it even without the disaffiliation. They might have broken that leadership, but I don't think it's not that quick. But I know that in our own local, there was a real... they held meetings and conferences, and they had their own organizations set up. They had their own secretary, president, and that. The whole setup was there, just duplicated the regular union, the elected representatives. And they would hold their meetings and decide what they were going to do, how they were going to work to disrupt the local functionings. And this has been going on for 3-4 years.